I'm Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst. You've probably heard that you should be eating more seafood, but maybe that seafood counter is intimidating, or maybe you don't know how to prepare it. That's why you need Wild Alaskan Company. As a member of Wild Alaskan Company, you'll receive a variety of delicious, perfectly portioned, wild-caught seafood delivered right to your door. You'll even have access to their team of fishmongers for any questions or recipes or cooking tips. They're so confident in the taste and quality of Alaska's seafood, they offer a 100% money-back guarantee. You can change or pause your delivery date anytime. How about that? Lots of flexibility. Right now, get $15 off your first box of wild-caught seafood when you visit wildalaskancompany.com/CBSPod. That's wildalaskancompany.com/CBSPod for $15 off your first box. wildalaskancompany.com/CBSPod.
Still waiting in line for your vaccine? Well, Hollywood moguls, New York socialites, and tourists from overseas didn't. They went to Florida, posting on social media and sparking outrage. That's because, early on, there were no residency requirements to get vaccinated in the state.
People were saying, listen, this is a resource that I know it's out there, and I'm going to use whatever leverage I have to get that resource. There were no rules.
It sounds like the Hunger Games.
That's a pretty good way of putting it.
Good evening.
As Ford Foundation president, Darren Walker oversees a $14 billion endowment. He thinks philanthropy needs a major rethink.
It has been normalized in American culture that you can work full time and still be poor. And Leslie, this isn't just an issue for African Americans and Latinx people. We have, for the first time in America, a generation of downwardly mobile white people.
Tonight, a story of solidarity, hope, and ultimately survival in the face of adversity. It took place more than 50 years ago, but when it was rediscovered last year, it caused a sensation. It's a tale of a group of schoolboys stranded on a remote and deserted island for more than 15 months.
It was hard. And I always pray God and I promise him, if you could get me back, I'll save you.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Sharon Alfonsi.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Hi, it's CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Yes, the IRS delayed the tax filing deadline to May 17th. And I know it's a drag. You're pulling out your old receipts. The only thing that could make that whole process even more fun is if identity thieves somehow were to get a hold of one of those tax forms with your personal information. Then you'd be in real trouble. LifeLock monitors uses of your personal information, alerts you to possible suspicious activity, and if you become a victim of identity theft, there will be a dedicated U.S.-based specialist who will work to fix it. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock helps you keep what's yours. Join today by going to LifeLock.com/CBS to save up to 25% off your first year. That's LifeLock.com/CBS to save 25% off your first year.
This past week, President Biden said 90% of U.S. adults will be eligible for the COVID vaccine by April 19th and will be able to get their shots within 5 miles of their home. That'll be welcome news to many in Florida. For 3 months, we've been reporting around Palm Beach County, the third largest in the state. It's home to old money millionaires, but also some of the poorest day laborers and farm workers in America. During those months, we watched Florida's vaccine rollout deteriorate into a virtual free-for-all and watched as some wealthy and well-connected residents cut the line, leaving other Floridians without a fair shot. This is the town of Palm Beach. Privacy hedges hide beachfront mansions and a healthy share of billionaires.
More than 80% of the town's seniors have been vaccinated. Bram Maitlis was one of the first.
I was the lucky one that had my phone in my hands, pushed the link to make the appointment, and had an appointment.
On January 5th, Maitlis, a retired businessman, got his first shot at a fire station just a block from his home. A few days earlier, the town had been given 1,000 doses from the state. The vaccine was in short supply. Residents were thrilled, but neighboring towns were upset that Palm Beach was the only town in all of Palm Beach County to get the life-saving shots for their seniors.
I don't think that they got it for any other reason than being prepared.
To be prepared, you have to have resources. And so I think a lot of people look at Palm Beach and say, well, they got the vaccine because they're a rich community.
I really think it has nothing to do with the resources in this particular case. Absolutely not.
The Palm Beach Fire Chief said they spend months training staff and setting up locations to administer the vaccine quickly. But a bridge away in West Palm Beach, they say they were just as prepared. You were ready in West Palm Beach for the vaccine.
Absolutely. And I even put my signature on a letter to let the governor and the county know that we were ready, willing and able.
Keith James is the mayor of West Palm Beach, which is not on the beach at all, but the intercoastal waterway. The median income in West Palm Beach is about $28,000 a year, compared to $70,000 in the town of Palm Beach. James told us after he and other mayors complained about the town of Palm Beach getting the 1,000 doses, the county's health director took the blame, calling it a miscommunication.
Listen, the county health director has fallen on the sword on that and said it was her bad, her organization's bad. They made a mistake. But isn't it funny that these mistakes only happen in communities that have that kind of wealth? They didn't make a mistake and send 1,000 doses to the poorest communities in our county.
Mayor James is among a number of community leaders who say the state's vaccination rollout has favored the wealthy. Florida's rollout started pretty typically. The first doses were given to healthcare workers and nursing home residents in early December. But then, a few weeks later, Governor Ron DeSantis, breaking from CDC guidelines, announced he would not vaccinate teachers and essential workers next, but instead put seniors first, making anyone 65 or over eligible for the vaccine, the first in the country to do that. DeSantis said seniors were at highest risk.
They will have priority over ordinary workers who are under 65, and I think that that's the appropriate way to do.
Florida's 4.5 million seniors started competing against each other for the vaccine.
Stay in line and stay socially distanced.
In the rush, public health department phone lines failed and computer sites crashed.
Internet issues are my biggest problems.
Kara Masuga, a teacher, tried to increase the odds of getting her mom an appointment.
So I have a school-issued Chromebook. I have my own personal laptop. I have my husband's iPad. I have my ancient iPad. And all four of those screens, it's very deflating. I missed it again today.
In some places, seniors waited 17 hours for a shot, but not everyone was so patient. Almost immediately, the line jumping started.
But it was incredibly frustrating.
In West Palm Beach, Mayor James says he was still trying to secure vaccines for his town's firefighters when he learned that at a nursing home in town, some board members and their wealthy pals got vaccinated, even though those doses were only supposed to be given to elderly residents and staff. Then the private jets started arriving. Hollywood moguls, New York socialites, and tourists from overseas were getting vaccinated in Florida, posting on social media and sparking outrage. Early on, there were no residency requirements to get vaccinated in the state.
People were saying, listen, this is a resource that I know it's out there, and I'm going to use whatever leverage I have to get that resource. There were no rules.
It sounds like the Hunger Games.
That's a pretty good way of putting it. And those who had the fiscal resources were going to use them in whatever way they could to get this vaccine.
By February 1st, casualties of the chaotic rollout became clear. State data revealed of the more than 160,000 residents in Palm Beach County who'd been vaccinated, only 2% were Black and 3% Hispanic, even though minorities make up almost half the county. State Representative Omari Hardy, a Democrat, says it's all about access.
At the beginning of this pandemic, Black people, Hispanics, people of color, we bore the full force of this pandemic, overrepresented in the hospitalizations, overrepresented in the deaths. And now on the back end of the pandemic, we're bearing the full force of it as well, because we don't have the same access to the vaccine.
Some people have said that the minority community is distrusting of the vaccine and doesn't want the vaccine. What do you think of that narrative?
That's an excuse for people who don't want to do the work required to ensure that the distribution of this vaccine is equitable.
And nowhere was that more challenging than here. This is the Glades. It's 44 miles west of the town of Palm Beach, also in Palm Beach County. 31,000 people call the Glades home. Rivers of sugarcane line the roads, and the air is thick with the smell of molasses. About 90% of residents are Black and Latino. Many live below the poverty line. By March, 11 weeks into the rollout, more than half the seniors in the Glades had still not been vaccinated.
Have they taken the vaccine yet? Are they interested in the vaccine?
For months, Tammy Jackson Moore, a community organizer, has been going door to door trying to fix that.
Out here? Yeah.
We were with her when we met 91-year-old Annie Pearl Cornelius on her porch.
Do you drive?
No, ma'am.
Do you have a computer?
No, ma'am.
Annie Pearl told us she wanted to get the vaccine for months, but couldn't make an appointment.
A lot of people still have flip phones. So there were a lot of challenges in our community as it relates to people trying to make appointments for vaccinations.
But the biggest challenge for residents of the Glades wasn't just making appointments, it was getting to them. That's because back in January, the governor made another game-changing move. He announced he was partnering with Publix grocery stores across the state to distribute the vaccine in their pharmacies. But as part of the program in Palm Beach County, most seniors could no longer get vaccine appointments through their public health departments. They had to go to Publix instead.
I was shocked because I know that we don't have a Publix in our community. And then I got angry, because I personally knew three people that had passed from COVID. And I knew that this was not going to be good for this community.
Belle Glade is one of the poorest communities, not just in Palm Beach County, but in the state of Florida. So you have lots of folks who don't have cars.
How far would someone from Belle Glade have to go to get to a Publix?
The nearest Publix to Belle Glade is about 25 miles.
That's pretty significant if you don't drive.
You have to catch two buses to get to the nearest Publix from the Glades. It's 34 stops, more than 2 hours round trip. A daunting task in the middle of a pandemic, especially if you're elderly. So why did the governor choose Publix? Campaign finance reports obtained by 60 Minutes show that weeks before the governor's announcement, Publix donated $100,000 to his political action committee, friends of Ron DeSantis. Julie Jenkins Fancelli, heiress to the Publix fortune, has given $55,000 to the governor's PAC in the past, and in November, Fancelli's brother-in-law, Hoyt R. Barnett, a retired Publix executive, donated $25,000. Publix did not respond to our request for comment about the donations. Governor DeSantis is up for re-election next year.
I imagine Governor DeSantis's office would say, look, we privatized the rollout because it's more efficient and it works better.
It hasn't worked better for people of color. Before, I could call the public health director. She would answer my calls. But now, if I want to get my constituents information about how to get this vaccine, I have to call a lobbyist from Publix. That makes no sense. They're not accountable to the public.
Distributing vaccines is lucrative. Under federal guidelines, Publix, like any other private company, can charge Medicare $40 a shot to administer the vaccine. We wanted to ask Governor DeSantis about the deal, but he declined our request for an interview. We caught up with him south of Orlando.
Publix, as you know, donated $100,000 to your campaign, and then you rewarded them with the exclusive rights to distribute the vaccination in Palm Beach.
So first of all, what you're saying is wrong.
How is that not pay to play?
That's a fake narrative. I met with the county mayor. I met with the administrator. I met with all the folks at Palm Beach County, and I said, here's some of the options. We can do more drive-through sites. We can give more to hospitals. We can do the Publix. And they said, we think that would be the easiest thing for our residents.
But Melissa McKinley, the county commissioner in the Glades, told us the governor never met with her about the Publix deal.
The criticism is that it's pay to play, Governor.
It's wrong. It's a fake narrative. I just disabused you of the narrative, and you don't care about the facts because obviously I laid it out for you in a way that is irrefutable.
Well, I
and so it's clearly not.
Isn't there the nearest Publix to the Glades is 30 miles away? That's actually a fact.
A federal complaint raises other questions about the governor's vaccine distribution decisions and alleges Governor DeSantis was discriminating when he handpicked communities for pop-up sites across the state. One of those communities was Lakewood Ranch in Manatee County, just south of Tampa. In February, the governor announced he was giving 3,000 doses to the community.
We saw a need. We want to get the numbers up for seniors.
But what the governor didn't mention was that Lakewood Ranch developer Pat Neal has donated $135,000 to the Friends of Ron DeSantis PAC, or that only residents from two zip codes would be allowed to get the shots, and those two zip codes have some of the highest income levels and lowest COVID infection rates in the county. When the governor was questioned about it, he threatened to take all the vaccine back.
But look, I mean, if Manatee County doesn't like us doing this, then we are totally fine with putting this in counties that want it.
Annie Pearl Cornelius got her first shot last month at a weekly vaccination site the state set up in the Glades. The local CVS and Walgreens have been given vaccine too. There is no shortage of takers.
Today was my day of luck.
State Democratic leaders are calling for the Justice Department to investigate whether Governor DeSantis was rewarding high-dollar donors with special access to the vaccine.
This is a once-in-a-century pandemic. Someone shouldn't have a better chance to survive because they have money or because they can write a check to someone or because they have access to powerful people.
Imagine if your job were to give away upwards of $500 million a year trying to make the world a better place. That is the enviable or perhaps unenviable task of Darren Walker, president of one of this country's largest and most prominent philanthropies, the Ford Foundation. A gay black man who grew up poor in a single-parent home in rural Texas, Darren Walker is probably not who Henry Ford would have chosen to give away the proceeds of the family fortune. Walker believes that in this time of stark and growing inequality, of staggering wealth for a few, but stagnation for far too many, philanthropy needs a major rethink. And he's using his checkbook and his charm to make the case that generosity is no longer enough.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm Darren Walker, and I have
as Ford Foundation president. Darren Walker oversees a $14 billion endowment and a landmark headquarters building in Manhattan, where more than 1,500 grants are made each year to nonprofit organizations in the U.S. and around the world. Its grants helped create giants like Public Broadcasting and Sesame Street, Human Rights Watch, and Head Start, a program Walker says made a huge difference in his own life as a poor kid in East Texas. He was in its very first class.
Were you even aware? Did you even know what the Ford Foundation was?
I had no idea what the Ford Foundation was. I didn't know what policy was. But I knew that I was a lucky child. And I always felt my country was cheering me on.
Walker fears that kids living in poverty now don't feel cheered on by their country. So after he was chosen to lead the foundation in 2013, he'd been a vice president before that, he did something radical.
All of our grant making in the U.S. and around the world.
He announced that every Ford Foundation grant moving forward would have as its mission fighting inequality in all its forms.
Inequality is the greatest harm to our democracy because inequality asphyxiates hope.
His argument is that generosity is insufficient. The real goal of giving should be justice. What's the difference between generosity and justice?
Generosity actually is more about the donor, right? So when you give money to help a homeless person, you feel good. Justice is a deeper engagement where you are actually asking, what are the systemic reasons that put people out onto the streets? Generosity makes the donor feel good. Justice implicates the donor.
Because you're telling the donor they're going to have to change themselves.
And that they contribute. You're the person who won't let a homeless shelter come into your neighborhood.
Makes you uncomfortable.
That's the point.
At the Ford Foundation, we know that inequality limits the potential of all people.
As part of the foundation's new direction, Walker changed how it invests its endowment, moving $1 billion into what are called mission-related investments, like companies building affordable housing. He reduced funding to marquee names, like Lincoln Center, while increasing grants to the Apollo Theater and Studio Museum in Harlem.
Build, a $1 billion initiative that gives...
Another innovation, a new program called Build, which gives $1 billion in grants to nonprofits and allows them to decide how to spend the money.
The organization is always in the driver's seat.
Even if it's on adding staff or new computers.
This is counterintuitive because I think most people really want to know that the vast majority of the money they give is going to the program itself.
All of the unexciting parts of a nonprofit has to be paid for. Technology and infrastructure, paying the rent. It is both arrogant and ignorant to believe that you can give money to an organization for your project and not be concerned about the infrastructure that makes your project possible.
Walker also made changes internally. He sold the foundation's old art collection, 400 works by white artists, all but one of the men, and bought new works by more diverse contemporary artists, like this Kehinde Wiley portrait of a woman from Brooklyn depicted as royalty, which he put right at the foundation's entrance. Walker comes from a large Southern family whose matriarch was the daughter of slaves. He grew up in rural Ames, Texas, the segregated part of a county ironically named Liberty. COVID prevented us from traveling to Ames with Walker, but a local camera crew was able to find his first house, now abandoned, so he could give us a virtual tour.
This house was a little shotgun shack on a dirt road. The thing about a shotgun house is it usually has a door and two rooms.
Walker's mother, a nurse's aide, raised him and his younger sister on her own.
Did you ever meet your father?
I met my father once. I was about 4 years old, and my cousin brought me by and said, Joe, this is your son, Darren. And don't you want to say hello to him? And he wouldn't come out of the house, or I actually never saw his face because the screen door covered most of his face.
That is so painful.
I think it's painful, but I think it's also, there's a resilience that comes from that.
I knew the Lord had something good in store for Darren.
The resilience really came, Walker says, from his mother, Beulah Spencer.
Education, education, education.
Who saved up to buy the Encyclopedia Britannica for her kids, one volume at a time.
What was Darren like as a little boy?
Oh, my God. I had to pay him to stop talking so much. I say, Darren, if you just be quiet for 25 minutes, I'm going to give you a quarter.
He was a strong student, was elected to his mostly white high school student council, and attended UT Austin on scholarship for college and law school. He moved to New York to work at a top law firm, then in banking, selling bonds, and met his decades-long partner, David, who passed away suddenly 2 years ago. Walker put his younger sisters through college, then left banking to do community development work in Harlem, and has been in philanthropy ever since.
I'm just proud of him. Very, very proud of him.
Especially so when that chatty little boy brought her to a state dinner at the White House, where it was she who didn't stop talking.
I was talking to President Obama, and Darren standing at the background saying, "Mother, move, move."
But she broke protocol, Leslie.
What'd she do?
Because she was supposed to briefly greet the president and move on. She grabbed his hand with her hand and wouldn't let go.
But she had something to tell the president, right?
Yes, I told him we were praying for him.
Hi, Bob Spill. How are you?
I'm so much better now.
If Walker has a superpower, it's being able to get along easily with just about everyone. Pre-COVID, he mingled comfortably with New York high society.
That was a different party. Okay.
Many his close friends. With a salary of almost $1 million, he says he knows what it is to be in the bottom 1% and now the top.
Let me be clear, Leslie. I am a capitalist. I believe there is no better way to organize an economy than capitalism.
But he says the system has gotten skewed, with the richest 90 people owning as much wealth as the bottom half of the country combined.
I want to challenge capitalism to do what it's supposed to do, and
that is
to provide opportunity.
What broke?
So he goes on business channels, calling on corporations.
What happened to those profit-sharing plans for workers?
To stop putting shareholders ahead of their workers.
It's unthinkable to me that it has been normalized in American culture that you can work full time and still be poor. That is antithetical to our idea of this country. And Leslie, this isn't just an issue for African Americans and Latinx people. We have, for the first time in America, a generation of downwardly mobile white people.
They're making less than their fathers did.
That has huge implications for our politics.
What's interesting is that usually when change comes, the leader is outside the tent shouting in. You're inside. You're going to all these galas.
As a person who is sometimes in the room, I think one of the things that I do in the room is to talk about uncomfortable truths.
And often people in the room are swayed. Walker pulled off a reconciliation between the Ford family and the foundation after a nearly 40-year estrangement. Henry Ford II severed relations in the 70s after clashes over bringing women onto the board and policies he considered too liberal. Walker used that superpower of his and reached out to matriarch Martha Firestone Ford, then convinced Henry Ford III to join a far more diverse board.
Henry, what do you have to say about this? Just have to
Pretty
say.
Pretty heavy, Darren.
This was the board's last in-person meeting before the COVID-19 pandemic struck.
I can't breathe!
Then George Floyd was killed, both thrusting issues of inequality to the center of the national conversation as never before, just as nonprofits, including those in the arts, were fighting for their lives.
Theaters went dark. Museums closed down. All of the kinds of things that we support here at the foundation were in need. So people were panicked.
Every one of you had a role to play in.
Working from home, Walker thought up a secret plan, something no foundation had ever done, raise $1 billion by issuing bonds, so the foundation could double its payments to needy grantees in the arts and racial justice. The bonds were rated AAA and sold out in less than an hour.
It had to be that your background suddenly came in because you were a bond salesman.
To be totally candid, it was less my knowledge of the bond market and more the urgency I felt to do something.
Walker is calling on everyone to do something. He's turned the Ford Foundation building into a vaccination site. And in a provocative New York Times op-ed,
He wrote that people with wealth and power need to share some. You're asking people who are invested in the system as it is, that grants them all the privilege, to give that up. I don't know if it's within human nature.
I agree with you, Leslie. It's not human nature to give up privilege, particularly if you feel it's hard-earned. But at the end of the day, we elites need to understand that while we may be benefiting from this inequality, ultimately, we are undoing the very fabric of America. We are going to have to give up some of our privilege if we want America to survive.
Annie's Kit Clubs provide creativity delivered directly to your door. Annie's Young Woodworkers Kit Club is perfect for the young builder in your life. Every month, your child will receive a high-quality, all-in-one woodworking project with all the necessary materials, requiring little to no supervision. Projects are geared toward ages 7 to 12, and younger kids can enjoy them with a grown-up or big sibling to help. Each kit includes illustrated step-by-step instructions that allow children to easily complete each project. Your child's first three kits will include various high-quality tools, sized just for them. These kits introduce a wide variety of woodworking skills, like using sandpaper to round off edges, handling a hammer, and so much more. A membership to Annie's Young Woodworkers Kit Club makes a great gift for the child in your life. Subscriptions are month-to-month, cancel at any time. As a special offer, you can get the first kit for 50% off. Go to annieskitclubs.com/CBS. That's annieskitclubs.com/CBS for 50% off your first kit.
Now, Holly Williams on assignment for 60 Minutes.
Tonight, we have a story of solidarity, hope, and ultimately survival in the face of adversity. It took place more than 50 years ago, but when it was rediscovered last year, it caused a sensation. It's a tale of a group of schoolboys stranded on a remote and deserted island for more than 15 months. It might remind you of the famous novel, Lord of the Flies, by William Golding. But as you'll see, the outcome of this real-life story could not have been more different.
The story begins in 1965. Manu Totau and five of his friends were studying at a boarding school in Tonga, an island nation in the Pacific Ocean. Bored, rebellious, and yearning for adventure, they stole a traditional whaling boat, and with reckless abandon, they set off for Fiji.
Did it have an engine?
No engine.
But, Mano, isn't Fiji about 500 miles from Tonga?
A little bit less.
Did you have a map or a compass?
No.
The teenagers might have been brought up on the sea, but they soon figured out they'd made a terrible mistake. On the first night, a violent storm ripped the sails from the mast and tore off the boat's rudder. For over a week, their crippled boat drifted aimlessly. 17-year-old Sione Fatau, the oldest of the group, told us they were convinced they'd die.
No food, no water. We was just drifting around by the wind. And after 8 days, we saw the island.
It was a volcanic island jutting out from the sea. As the boat neared, a wave sent it crashing into the rocky shoreline, leaving it in pieces. The exhausted teenagers struggled ashore.
The only thing we do, grabbing each other together and say a prayer. Thank you, God.
The schoolboys later discovered they drifted 100 miles from where they'd set off and had landed on the island of Ata. On maps, nothing more than an uninhabited speck. It was a story so remarkable that later an Australian television crew brought the teenagers back to Ata to reenact their experience. In the film, Sione, Manu and their friends show how they survived.
They were able to salvage an oar and a piece of wire, and with this, they set out to catch what they hoped would be their first meal in 8 days.
They demonstrate how they ate the fish they caught raw, and quenched their thirst by raiding the nests of seabirds, drinking their blood and their raw eggs.
Any food, anything to drink.
Any food, no matter how awful it is and how dirty it is, it's a very beautiful thing to have it in that time.
When they regained enough strength, Mano and Sione told us, they climbed up to the island's forested plateau, where they found a clay pot, a machete, and chickens, all left behind by a small Tongan community that lived on Ata before being ripped from their home by slave traders a century earlier. But they told us everything changed when they finally made fire and began cooking hot meals.
How did you stop it from going out?
I tell the guys, everybody have a duty for the fire. You have to take care of the fire and you have to say prayer for that night. When get up in the morning, it's still going.
The teenage runaway showed remarkable resourcefulness, building a hut out of palm fronds, establishing a garden with bananas and beans, and setting up a roster to keep a lookout for passing ships. They even built a badminton court and a makeshift gym. They lived in harmony, they told us, most of the time.
But come on, Mano, you were teenage boys. You must have had arguments.
We did, and we disagreed.
They cooled off by walking to opposite sides of the island, Mano says, though sometimes things got out of hand.
So if there was a fight, how did you stop it?
You smack him or something like that and tell him, shut up and cool down, sit down, listen.
There must have been times when you were depressed, when you thought that you would never see your families again.
It was hard. And I always pray God and I promise him, if you could get me back, I'll save you the rest of my life.
For more than 50 years, the real-life story of Sione, Mano and their friends was little known outside of Tonga. Until Dutch historian and best-selling author Rutger Bregman stumbled across it on the internet. He flew across the world to meet Mano and made the story the cornerstone of his new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History.
And I just couldn't understand how this had not become, you know, one of the most famous stories of the 20th century. I just couldn't understand it because it's just extraordinary. Six kids on an island for 50 months and they survived. How?
Like millions of others, Bregman had read the fictional tale of marooned schoolboys, Lord of the Flies, which for generations has been taught in high schools around the world.
I think we ought to have a chief to decide things.
The novel, later made into a film, is a nightmarish account of a group of British boys stranded on an uninhabited island. They divide into two competing tribes and descend into violence, culminating in mayhem and murder.
There's this really old theory in Western culture that our civilization is just a thin veneer, just a thin layer, and that when something bad happens, say there's a natural disaster or you shipwreck on an island and you have the freedom to establish your own society, that people reveal who they really are. You know, that people deep down are just selfish.
And you're saying that basic idea underlying the novel Lord of the Flies is wrong. You're saying that would never happen?
Well, if tens of millions of children around the globe still have to read Lord of the Flies in school today, I think they also deserve to know about this one time in all world history when real kids shipwrecked on a real island, because that's a very different story.
A story of cooperation, hope, and eventually salvation. In September 1966, after 15 long months, Australian lobster fisherman Peter Warner was sailing near Ata when he spotted a burned-out patch. When he went closer, he was shocked to see a human figure.
And this first figure was swimming towards us, doing the Australian crawl, as I call it. And then another five bodies leapt off the cliff and into the water and followed him.
They clambered aboard and told the crew how they'd run away from boarding school and ended up shipwrecked. Peter radioed to Nuku'alofa, the capital of Tonga, to check out their story.
And the operator very tearfully said, "It's true. These boys were students at this college. They've been given up for dead. Funerals have been held, and now you found them." So that was a very emotional moment for all of us.
So you knew you were going home?
Yes.
How did that feel?
Like walking through the door to heaven.
But heaven would have to wait. When they arrived back in port, they were immediately arrested.
So Peter Warner rescued you and took you back to Nuku'alofa, where everyone thought that you were dead, and then you were arrested?
Yeah, we were arrested because we stole the boat.
Peter Warner told us he paid off the owner of the stolen boat and finally sailed the runaway schoolboys back to their home island, accompanied by the Australian television crew that had flown in to film their story. They captured the teenagers' reunion with their families.
Our boys have come back.
My mom, she was swimming out before I get out the boat. I'm the first one going to the beach. And give me a hug.
Never had there been such joy.
The whole population of this little island were on the beach, hugging the boys. Parents were crying. Then the party started. 6 days of feasting.
The story has never been forgotten in these islands, but when a British newspaper published a chapter of Rutger Bregman's book last May, the tale of the Tongan teenagers went viral. 7 million people read it within days. Hollywood studios got into a bidding war for the film rights.
Why were so many people all around the world surprised and captivated by your telling of the story?
Maybe we needed to hear it. Maybe especially right now, in the midst of a pandemic, is that people were looking for a story that gave them hope about a different way of living together, a different society is possible, that it's not just violence and selfishness and greed within human nature, but that we can build on something different. Maybe that's why.
It's been 55 years since the shipwrecked schoolboys were rescued. They've never had any doubt how or why they survived.
I think the culture where we come from, we are close, really close family. We share everything. We bore, but we love each other.
The teenagers had no interest in going back to the classroom. At first, they worked for Peter Warner, who set up a fishing business in Tonga. Sione, as promised, later became a minister. He's now the head of the Church of Tonga in America. Mano trained as a chef and moved to Australia. For half a century, he and Peter Warner have been best friends. Whenever they can, they go out for a sail, forever pulled back to the Pacific Ocean, where their friendship began.
Why do you guys get along so well, you know, all these years after the rescue?
Well, I think that we feel strongly in us that we have something to helping one another on it.
Yeah. And also
teaching one another on it.
And also we have the common beliefs that got you through that trial on the island, you know, love, compassion,
yeah,
justice, unity.
We both believe in the same thing.
The teenagers composed a song when they were on the island of Ata, Sio Sio Noa, seeing nothing every day. It takes Mano back to a time when they were longing for home and before they could ever imagine that their story might have lessons for us all.
te ke toki ngalope iha aku mate.
I'm Leslie Stahl. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes. Happy Easter, and hope you had a joyful Passover.